You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there are two doctors in the house. We'll talk to an artist who decided to mash up children's books and hip-hop. Now, the coronavirus outbreak has had far-reaching impacts on our economy, and that includes nonprofit organizations. A new survey from six UW System schools asked more than 600 nonprofits across the state how they've been affected. Findings show that many nonprofits have had to lay off staff, despite seeing more demand in many cases for their programs. Megan Hart is a reporter for WPR based in Green Bay. Megan, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, nonprofit can cover a lot of ground, from, you know, museums and other cultural institutions to service providing organizations. Let's start with that second group. What do we know from this survey about how the outbreak affected the need for services from many of these nonprofits?
Well, a lot of these nonprofits do say that there is a greater demand for their services. And of course, they provide a very wide range of services. You know, kids are out of school. A lot of them are used to getting meals there. So maybe these nonprofits provide meals. Some of them provide things like housing for domestic abuse victims. And of course, now with Safer at Home, you know, a lot of people are in their homes. And so a lot of those services are things that, just because we're social distancing, they can't be neglected.
What do we know about how nonprofits are being affected as organizations in terms of their staffing and their budgets?
Yeah, it seems like they're being affected in quite a few ways. 47% of organizations said that they have already reduced staffing. More said that it's a possibility moving forward. About 80% of the organizations that responded said that they are having fewer volunteers. And of course, volunteers provide a lot of the support that nonprofits need to be able to provide their services. And funding, you know, a lot of people who work in the for-profit sector have experienced layoffs or furloughs, and so nonprofits maybe are seeing fewer donations. And then some nonprofits also earn revenue different ways, and some of them have seen revenue drops. For example, I spoke to the Building for Kids Children's Museum in Appleton. This is usually the busiest time of year for them because they bring in most of their money through ticket sales, and they're currently closed. I also did a story recently on zoos across Wisconsin that said the same thing. Here in Green Bay, the new zoo said that if they're closed for a couple months this time of year, that could equate to half of their revenue for the year.
Yeah, what kind of things are these nonprofits saying about their futures, even as we start to reopen? How worried are they?
Yeah, I think that they certainly the study shows that they are worried about their futures in a few ways. Of course, financially, more than 50% said that they were worried about just being able to pay rent. So even in the most basic ways, they're struggling. But they have a lot to consider when it comes to reopening beyond just the financial aspect. Of course, there's the safety of their staff members and their clients, their volunteers. There's also, you know, I will say that Bryce Lord, who was sort of the lead researcher on this study from UW-Milwaukee, he said it seems likely that there are nonprofits that will not reopen after this, just as there are for-profit businesses that won't reopen as a result of coronavirus. But he said that the nonprofit sector is used to providing, you know, finding ways to provide services that either, you know, for-profit businesses or the government won't provide or can't provide. And so it's really a resilient area. And so while it may look different after coronavirus, he said, you know, we should expect many nonprofits to come out strong.
Megan Hart is a reporter for WPR based in Green Bay. She's looking at a new study from six UW System schools looking at nonprofits, how they're dealing with coronavirus and the economic impact of the novel coronavirus. Have we seen nonprofits changing their services or their programming in ways to deal with some of the challenges of the outbreak, Megan?
Yeah, a lot of nonprofits, of course, have moved online, about 28%, according to the study. The Building for Kids, the Children's Museum in Appleton, they've moved a lot of their programming online. They also are putting together activity bags for kids around the community, so their staff are putting those bags together and delivering them for kids who maybe don't have access to online services. About more than 10% of nonprofits said that they have changed their mission or they've pivoted, at least for the time being, to provide essential services. So maybe they don't normally provide things like food or shelter to their clients, but they're finding that their usual clients do now need those things as a result of the pandemic. So they've shifted to begin offering those services. And then, unfortunately, just over 10% of nonprofits have actually had to suspend their services. According to the survey, as a result of the coronavirus. And one of the examples that the survey authors included was an arts organization in Whitewater that relied heavily on volunteers who were students at UW-Whitewater. And when those students were sent home, the two full-time staff members could no longer run the business, run the nonprofit on their own. And so they actually are closed for the time being. So it kind of runs the gamut depending on what kind of services they offer. And also, the survey showed that smaller nonprofits have been more greatly affected by the coronavirus than larger organizations.
Now, we've talked on the show over the last couple of months about federal aid packages that have helped businesses weather the storm some. Have nonprofits in Wisconsin been able to access that kind of funding or comparable funding from the federal government?
Yeah, about 55% of nonprofits in Wisconsin, based on the survey, have applied for Paycheck Protection Program loans. So those are designed to allow the organizations to keep their staff on their payroll so that they're not going on unemployment. And those have been important for nonprofits here in Wisconsin because the sector does employ a lot of people. At the same time, they don't really necessarily make up for lost revenue or a dip in donations. But those kinds of programs have been helpful. One thing, though, that some nonprofits said during the survey was that they fear that they won't be able to necessarily meet the requirements set forth in grants that they've already received or grants that they typically receive because it's not as easy for them in many cases to reach clients, especially from marginalized communities who may not be able to work with online.
We'll leave it there. Megan, thanks for sharing this with us today.
So thank you for having me.
That's Megan Hart, reporter for WPR based in Green Bay. She was with us today to talk about a new report from UW-Milwaukee on how COVID-19 is affecting Wisconsin nonprofit organizations. Coming up, if you're out gardening and you love that smell of dirt, you might wonder, well, what is that smell? Well, hint, it's not the dirt. We'll find out why coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, are you getting your hands dirty in the yard now that it's warmer? We'll get down into the weeds of why dirt smells the way it does. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on a musician's new project with PBS Wisconsin called The Light.
Jalarina Sanders is an artist who does it all. Her craft is steeped in theater and music, so...
music, composition, and writing, so both the instrumentation and the lyrics.
Plus playwright, actor, graphic and visual artist, and nonprofit founder. Jalarina grew up in Tampa, Florida, and was raised in an artistic family.
Oh, yeah. I come from that dirty, that scurvy dirty, where the curb is perfect, eating hot dogs in the church parking lot. My daddy four-wheeler in three parking spots. You wanna come up?
My uncle, my mother's brother, is an MC, and he was the first person that I ever personally met that rapped. I heard him rap one day, and he showed us like his mixtape, and I think I was maybe 5 or 6, and I asked him to show me how to put together a bar and then a verse, because I had been watching Da Brat a lot in TLC, and I wanted to do what they did.
Not long after, Jalarina started writing her own raps. That led to slam poetry in high school, and eventually she became a cohort in University of Wisconsin-Madison's First Wave program, which integrates hip-hop and arts with traditional studies. Jalarina's music is taking center stage again with a new PBS Wisconsin digital series, The Light. It features a series of music videos exploring love and identity.
I'll hit the light before it gets dark, 'cause I'm the one who memorizes. master BDO. Each song exists in the whole set. So it's three different songs, and I am playing myself and my mom.
It addresses a difficult moment in their relationship, but Jalarina is excited to share it with her mom.
Life has great moments and it has not so great moments. So to talk about and work through and make a show of the not so great moments, it's been a challenge, but it's been so fulfilling and edifying to be able to take very personal moments and create the world that existed around them like 10 years ago in a set. That blew my mind.
Of course the parent was cooking. Of course she was stressed. Of course I jumped in front of a bullet train with a text. Of course she read it loud, but throw up in her mouth. Of course I couldn't breathe enough to lie, get it out.
Jalarina's inspiration doesn't just come from her family. She says so many things push her creatively.
The gospel every day, that is like a whole world of inspiration. And then being around artists who love to play, I know some of my best work has come through me just sort of like playing around and enjoying just the creative process without the pressure of making something good.
Jalarina got her undergrad in psychology and master's in counseling psychology at UW. She says that knowledge absolutely plays into creating music.
So for example, I have a song where one friend is talking to another friend and telling her, hey, I know that you're probably depressed, but we don't have to use that word. However, I'm here for you and let's talk.
I know. You good, sis. But imagine what it'd be like if you gonna let me help you get through this. Cause it blessed me to bless you. Whoa, baby, God bless you. If it's hard to walk this thing out, I'ma make another beat for you to step to.
I have music about, like, my own struggles and just me sort of, like, dealing with anxiety or dealing with my ego or, like, whatever the case may be. People often suffer in silence and alone, and I want my art to be the enemy of that.
And I mean that death, where is your sting at? We was watching when that resurrection flipped your weed back up.
I'm constantly trying to produce work that would encourage and uplift. I was born knowing that I'm an artist and I create, and that's what I want to do forever and ever. Amen.
She was 5'3 with the nerve to find me. Squirming with the yearning to switch up assigned seats. Immaculately wrapped in a package of prime beats. With lyrics that describe what the laughter of God means.
Jalarina has made the move from Madison to Atlanta, where she's working on a number of projects. She's wrapping up a new album, releasing one song a month. She's also working on her second one-person show. To see Jalarina's videos featured on the PBS Wisconsin Digital Project, The Light, head over to wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, with warmer temperatures and various levels of quarantining in place, many of us have been getting our hands into the earth, gardening, weeding, other assorted yard maintenance. That earthy smell you get from soil can be satisfying. You feel accomplished, connected to nature. Wisconsin even has its own state soil, Anago silt loam. Here's the late legendary UW-Madison geology professor Francis D. Hole singing about it.
Antigo, with soil you know, Wisconsin's crops and livestock grow, and forests too on Antigo, and forests too on Antigo.
Well, whether it's Antigo, silt loam, or any other dirt, can the dirt itself actually take credit for that characteristic dirty smell? Science writer Jennifer Fraser recently dug into the topic on her blog, The Artful Amoeba, at Scientific American. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I think of the dirt itself as the minerals and so on. What is actually making the smell of the dirt that we, you know, we think of any time we dig into the soil?
So it's actually bacteria, incredibly enough. You know, growing up and being around dirt a lot, as most kids are, I always just kind of thought dirt smells like dirt. But when I was in college, I was taking a plant pathology class, and they happened to have a petri dish of soil bacteria. And when I took off the lid, it smelled just like dirt, but there was no dirt in there. And it suddenly struck me, dirt doesn't smell like dirt. It smells like bacteria.
And people sometimes, they might think bacteria, oh, yuck, disease. We're glad this bacteria is there, right? It does good stuff for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's there for our benefit explicitly. It's there because it likes dirt and it likes hanging out in dirt and it makes its living there. But it happens to be a source of most of the major antibiotics that we use in medicine today. So it actually is very useful bacteria for us.
So who are the bacterial dudes that are actually in that dirt making that smell?
So the bacteria are primarily in a genus called Streptomyces, which you may be familiar with if you've ever heard of the antibiotic streptomycin. It gets its name from these bacteria. Streptomyces are really interesting bacteria. They have an alternative lifestyle. It's unusual for bacteria. They look and act like fungi.
How so?
Well, they grow in filaments, and they make spores in chains and whorls and all kinds of crazy configurations, a lot like the fungi that grow on your moldy fruit.
Okay, so far so good, but why do they want to make that smell?
Okay, so that's a great question. They wondered about that, you know? And so we know that these bacteria make spores and they need to disperse them, but that's not always easy to do in soil. There's not a lot of wind, and water can be kind of unpredictable, but there's a lot of creepy crawlies in the soil. And so they thought, maybe somebody in the dirt might be dispersing this bacteria. So they built these little sticky traps in Sweden, of all places, and they baited them with these bacteria. And they also put some control traps in so they could tell what the difference was. And what showed up in the baited traps relative to the controls were springtails.
What's a springtail? I think I know what you're talking about. I read the piece, of course, but what is a springtail?
A springtail is a fascinating little animal that everyone would want as a pet if it was big, but it's the size of a period at the end of a sentence, so no one's ever heard of them. They're super cute, and they live in the dirt, and they're omnivores. They can eat all kinds of things, and they have this really cool forked butt flipper called a furcula that they use to launch themselves into the air in emergencies up to about 6 inches, which is pretty high for a period-sized animal.
I think you may be responsible for the first use of the phrase forked butt flipper on Central Time. We'll have to consult the archives on that.
Yeah.
I'll
wear that as a badge of honor.
So maybe these bacteria evolved this smell just to get the springtails to like come over and then help spread their offspring?
Yeah, so they tested the springtails. They tested their antennae to see if they could smell these chemicals, and indeed they could. It generated an electrical signal. And then they tested to see if they could actually spread the spores, both by kind of wallowing in them and also by eating the mycelium. And it turns out they can both ways. And eating the mycelium is obviously nutritious for the springtail, but more to the point, the spores emerge from the backside of the springtail still intact. So it's beneficial for Streptomyces also.
All right, now this is all cool, but the head-exploding moment of reading your piece here came to a vegetable that I like and nobody else in my family likes. It's beets. And the reason people don't like beets is that they said it smells and tastes like dirt, and that's not a coincidence. Tell us about
that. It's not. No, the plants that make beets, that plant family, is capable of making geosmin, which is the same exact chemical that these Streptomyces soil bacteria are making that smells like dirt.
So there is a reason. I just thought, beets, they live in dirt and they absorb the dirt. And that's, I'm eating dirt when I eat the beets. It's actually more complicated and cooler than that.
Yes, it is. That's right.
Though I guess I could be eating the dirt if I don't wash and peel them first.
It's probably good for you.
Now, getting back to these springtails, you mentioned the piece, so we should watch David Attenborough talk about them.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. He has a 2-minute video. It's from one of his longer, documentaries, but his little 2-minute take on springtails is just wonderful.
Okay, I'll have to check that. I've got to say, I pulled up a picture of springtails while we've been talking, and cute? Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't think so? Well, maybe you saw the lab rat springtails. Check out the wild ones.
Wild springtails. Okay, that's what I'll have to check out. Now, did doing this research on bacteria, well, first I should, before to set this question up, do you garden yourself? Are you somebody who's out playing in the dirt a lot?
Yes, I have an extensive garden in my backyard.
Okay, awesome. So you're used to this smell. Did researching, the bacterial causes of this smell, and I guess going back to your college experience, did it change the way you think of dirt and the smell that comes along with it?
I guess as a biology-trained person, it made it even more exciting for me. I mean, it's not just dirt perfume, I guess. It's actually serving a purpose, which is kind of, it's like the smell of ripe fruit. for a springtail. And that's kind of cool when you think about it.
And bringing it back to that point about how we get a lot of good antibiotics from these Streptomyces bacteria, that's because these bacteria, they're basically in a state of constant chemical warfare with other microorganisms. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a jungle out there in the dirt. There's so many things, and they're all fighting it out with each other for survival.
Wow. And we don't see any of it.
No, no, because we're huge.
So should we as humans change the way we think about the smell of soil, good, bad, indifferent?
I would say good. I think it's a cool story. And I mean, I always enjoyed the smell of dirt before I knew that story, but now it's even more meaningful.
If we have just like a home microscope we might have bought for our kids, say, when they're in elementary school, does it have magnification enough that we can see these bacteria, or are we out of luck there? Do we need something, college level and up?
I think you're out of luck on the bacteria unless you find a whole colony. The colonies can get on centimeter size scale. So if you find a whole fuzzy colony, you might be able to see it, although it'd be hard to tell from a fungus. But you are not out of luck on the springtails. You might well find a wild springtail.
Well, cool. Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing this with us. I appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
Been talking to Jennifer Frazier, science writer and author of The Artful Amoeba at Scientific American. Well, we asked you yesterday about things that might give you joy in tough times, either personally or big picture tough times. A lot of people here at WPR and amongst you said gardening was a big one. I want to know, is it the smell? Is that part of the experience for you, that smell of opening up that bag of potting soil or, turning over that first bit of soil in your garden? If you love that smell of dirt, well, now you know where it's coming from, these bacteria, let us know. Send us a poem in honor or just a few words in honor of the smell of dirt. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, Dr. Seuss meets Dr. Dre. We'll meet a Wisconsin performer who's putting a groove behind some grovulous poems. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. For the first time in nearly 9 years, American astronauts were planning on heading to space from the U.S. today, but bad weather kept the SpaceX rocket on the ground. We'll look at the crew is planning on doing and the future of American space exploration coming up. Now, if you're like 3.5 million people, you've already seen this video on YouTube. If you haven't, here's a listen.
Fox sucks, Fox knocks, knocks in box and Fox in socks, knocks on Fox in socks in box. Socks on Knox and Knox in box. Fox and socks on box on Knox.
That's Milwaukee-based multimedia artist Wes Tank. Let's get right to him to explain what we just heard there. Wes, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
It seems like a match made in heaven. Tell us what led you to put that together and what we just heard there.
Oh, well, one day I just found a copy of One Fish, Two Fish on the ground before a show, and I happened to have a Dr. Dre beat on my phone, and just spur of the moment decided to put the two together in rap form, and it was kind of, it worked out, and then I tried it again at a different show and realized, a lot of these books and a lot of these beats kind of go well together.
Yeah, did it take a lot of fitting and forcing to make the natural cadence of Dr. Seuss fit with the beats of Dr. Dre, or did it just kind of come naturally?
It was so natural, and every time I try one, some go better with others, but that's the thing, is it just works, and it just sort of clicks immediately, and I can tell when the vibe of the song and the vibe of the book are working together, so... pretty just instinctual and organic.
Now, is this the only combo you've tried, Dr. Seuss and Dr. Dre, or have you tried, Mo Willems and Vanilla Ice or anything? Or is this just the perfect combo and you're sticking with it?
Oh, I'm definitely trying a lot of other things. I've been experimenting quite a bit. I've been doing a little William Shakespeare, MF Doom, a little Pharrell and Lewis Carroll. And I'm just trying all sorts of different things right now because of how much people love the Dr. Seuss and Dr. Dre. I also have a lot of my own producer friends who I've worked with for a lot of years that I'm going to be working with more in the future.
Shakespeare, iambic pentameter. Does that match up with a straight 4/4 beat pretty well?
It's challenging. The more syllables you have, the more challenging it is, and you have to find the right rhythm and the right pacing. So definitely not easy.
We're talking to Milwaukee-based multimedia artist Wes Tank about his very popular YouTube videos where he mashes up Dr. Seuss words with the beats of Dr. Dre. Let's give another listen to one now, a bit from the Lorax.
The instant I finished, I heard a gazump. I looked and saw something pop out of the stump of the tree I chopped down. It was a sort of man. Describe him, that's hard. I don't know if I can. He was shortish and oldish and brownish and mossy. He spoke with a voice that was sharpish and bossy. Mister, he said with a sawdusty sneeze. I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. For the trees have no tongues. And I'm...
Wes, tell us about getting into character here, because we hear the two different main characters from the Lorax.
Yeah. I like to look at the pictures and imagine what they sound like. So I look at the Lorax and what he's all about, and I just, for some reason, Tom Waits comes to mind, and I have like a kind of a long lasting Tom Waits impression I've been working on for a long time, and I gave that to the Lorax. So and then the other one is just kind of, he's the onceler, and he talks about how he speaks with a sawdusty sneeze, and he's kind of like, he's got a little bit of more of a up here type of voice. And you want him to kind of go back and forth. So, you know, the one character might have like a higher pitched voice and the other one has a lower pitched voice. And so you want those like diametrically opposed forces to kind of work and get in people's heads a little bit, you know, so they separate them a little bit.
You started with this zany idea, and now these things have gone nuts online. Can you talk about the response you've gotten here?
Oh, it's been lovely. I mean, I feel so, my heart is warmed so much by the way people have responded. Parents, you know, have told me, you know, there's a lot of parents that are homeschooling right now, and that they said this is just a godsend for homeschooling, because it's, can be hard to get kids to want to pay attention to learning activities right now and when they're not in the school environment. So this kind of, you know, just, it's a little spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down. And you know, just, that's why we do story wraps. It's just kind of like, it's just a way to get literature into kids hands and get kids reading, you know.
You mentioned how this felt in your heart. Did it feel almost as though your heart had grown three sizes that day?
Absolutely. Probably even more. Maybe 3 million.
That makes me wonder, is the Grinch in the cards? I didn't see it on your site, at least not yet, I don't think.
Oh, well, you know, the really cool thing about the Dr. Seuss universe is that there's one for, you know, a lot of different occasions, and that's a little more down the Christmas line. And so we're looking at the long game with this project and plan to be doing this for a while. So look forward to that, you know, a little closer to Christmas time, I would say.
Now, I would think the target audience here would be kids, but I got to say, I was looking through some of your YouTube comments there. There were some grownups pointing out, yeah, I'm a, you know, 50-year-old dude, and I'm watching somebody rap Dr. Seuss videos, and I'm glad about it. This is appealing to people of all ages, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, I think people that grew up in the 90s grew up with the Dr. Dre and kind of gangster rap and things like that. And so there's that nostalgia. And then, like, everybody grew up with Dr. Seuss. So there's parents want to share that with their kids, and they love to share Dr. Dre with them, but in a child-friendly manner, I guess. And I think nostalgia is, like, contagious.
And as we wrap up, Wes, you've got the videos. There's some production in them, too. It's a lot of fun. When we can have live shows again, do you see maybe a full-on Dr. Seuss live performance in your future?
Oh, absolutely. I do a show at Bookworm Gardens every year. That's in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. It's like a storybook botanical garden. And so I'm already booked to play this year, and we don't know exactly how that's going to go. Hopefully we're able to have shows again by that point. It's in October, though. It's usually at the end of October. So, but yeah, absolutely. I'd love to play more shows. I'd love to play schools and theaters and whatever wants to have me play.
Wes, thanks a lot for sharing that with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That's Wes Tank, a multimedia artist based in Milwaukee. We talked to him about his viral video series mashing up Dr. Seuss books over Dr. Dre beats. Coming up, we'll talk about what was supposed to be today's historic SpaceX rocket launch and look at the company's future space travel plans. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, an expert on infectious disease talks about the risk of a second wave of coronavirus in the U.S. this year and what could be done to prevent or deal with it. That's tomorrow at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Right now, two American astronauts were supposed to be on their way to the International Space Station. Bad weather, though, at Kennedy Space Center in Florida this afternoon put those plans on hold. It would have been the first time the U.S. sent its own astronauts into orbit since July of 2011. They'll try again on Saturday. The two-person crew will be flying in a capsule called the Crew Dragon, which is attached to a Falcon 9 rocket. Both of those components belong to SpaceX, an aerospace manufacturing company owned by Elon Musk. The mission is a test flight called Demo 2. Assuming everything goes well, SpaceX is planned to launch its first operational crewed mission later this year. Mike Wall is a senior space writer for Space.com and the author of Out There, a scientific guide to alien life, antimatter, and human space travel for the cosmically curious. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today. Oop, do we have you, Mike?
Yeah.
Okay.
There. Can you hear me?
Yep, we gotcha. Can you tell us about the weather situation in Florida and why it shut down the launch for now?
Yeah, they were really close to actually launching today. They were just off by like 10 or so minutes. If they'd been able to kind of hold out for another 10 minutes or so, it looked like the weather was clearing, but there was still a little bit too much lightning and like a few other things. So, and it was an instantaneous launch window today, which means that they had to go right at the time, right at 4:33 Eastern. So they just couldn't wait around for the weather to clear. They just had to go. And yeah, that's really tight to do an instantaneous window, and it doesn't always work out, obviously.
Right, launching a rocket like this isn't just pushing a button whenever you feel like it. A lot of buildup goes into this, doesn't it?
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, a lot of it's driven by, I mean, you have to load the like super cold propellants at a certain time, and that's why this was an instantaneous window today. Because if you wait too long, then the fuel starts to warm up, and it changes the dynamics of the rocket and everything. It's not as efficient. So yeah, they just had to go at a certain time and didn't quite make it. Now we got to wait till Saturday.
Now, a lot of people have had their eyes on this mission today. Can you talk about the significance of this thing, a partnership, NASA astronauts, and then SpaceX technology?
Yeah, this is a big deal. I mean, for starters, it's the first crewed orbital launch from American soil since 2011 when the space shuttles retired. And it's the first time that we've actually that we're going to send astronauts into orbit on a private spacecraft atop of. And like a rocket that was privately built as well. So this is like a new paradigm of space exploration NASA has sort of pivoted toward. They started doing this in about 2010, where they started giving out contracts to fund the development of these private space vehicles to kind of actually fill the space shuttle shoes. And we're finally there now. You know, NASA, like at the time, the sort of rationale was we don't want to be spending so much time and so much energy and so much money just going up to Earth orbit and back. That's something that we think private industry can take care of. So once we hand over those sorts of reins to them, then we can concentrate more on going to the moon, going to Mars, doing the really difficult stuff that sort of NASA was built to do. And yeah, it's taken about 10 years since they started this push, and we're right on the doorstep now of it actually happening.
Now, some Americans have been up on the International Space Station over the last 9 years. How have they been getting there?
Yeah, that we have had to buy rides like aboard Russian spacecraft, Soyuz spacecraft. That's the only crew vehicle that's capable of getting to orbit now. And it costs it costs about $90 million per seat to buy a seat from the Russians. So that's not good financially. It's not great politically, I guess, to be like so totally dependent on a foreign power. And there are a bunch of different reasons why you don't want that kind of dependency if you're NASA or if you're the U.S. government in a broader sense.
Now, talk about this mission itself. If it had launched today or if and when it launches this weekend, what exactly are the astronauts doing here?
Yeah, this is a test flight. So they are they do have astronauts on board. And so it is like it's high stakes and it's really exciting. It's not like an operational mission. They're basically just putting this new spaceship, Crew Dragon capsule, through its paces, basically trying to validate it for human spaceflight and show that it's fully able to do all that sort of NASA wants it to do. So when it goes up, it'll take a little while to reach the space station. It was going to be about like 19 hours to chase the space station down if it had launched today. Like that's going to change probably for the Saturday mission. I think it's something like, I don't know, 31 hours or something like that. So it'll chase the space station down. And while that's happening, you know, they're going to be gathering all sorts of data about how the capsule's performing, what it's doing, how the navigation's doing, how are the solar arrays performing, and all the rest of it. And then once it gets up to the station, you know, they'll prove out that it can dock and do all the things that a spacecraft needs to do at the space station. And it's an interesting thing. We don't know yet how long this mission is going to last. It's going to be like 1 month to 4 months is the range. And so that all depends on how it's performing during the mission. And that'll guide the SpaceX judgment, NASA judgment on when they want to bring the astronauts back down to Earth. So like between 30 days and 4 months is how long this mission's going to last.
Tell us a little about the two astronauts who are in the project here.
Yeah, they're both NASA veterans. Doug Hurley, Bob Behnken, they've like both flew on the space shuttle. And in fact, Doug Hurley flew on the very last flight of the space shuttle back in 2011. So it's very fitting that he's going up on the first flight of Crew Dragon. So they know what they're doing, and they've actually been assigned to this role, to this sort of SpaceX role for a while. They've helped develop this spacecraft over time with SpaceX. You know, like they've been advisors to the SpaceX engineers. They've been kind of on the ground floor of this capsule's development, helping say, well, like this is a good system. Maybe we want to change this a little bit, or this isn't as comfortable as it could be. Maybe we want to tweak this design a little bit. So they're not just sort of passive observers or like passive passengers. They've been working with SpaceX for a couple of years now to kind of get the like final design of the spacecraft right.
We're talking to Mike Wall from space.com, author of the book Out There. We're talking about the postponed launch today of this joint NASA-SpaceX project, NASA astronauts, SpaceX technology, delayed by weather so far. Tell us a little bit about the company, Mike. SpaceX, I think, is a household word for people who follow space stories. For people who don't follow it as closely, what is this company?
Yeah, people probably know about Elon Musk. He actually started SpaceX back in 2002. So they have been around for a while. They've been flying to the space station since 2012. They actually have a different NASA contract to fly like robotic cargo missions with the sort of cargo version of Dragon when there's nobody on board. So they're very capable. They've done many, many missions that go to the space station. And in fact, last year, Crew Dragon actually docked to the space station during a test flight that didn't have any astronauts on board. So this like new astronaut capsule has actually been to the space station before. It just hasn't carried astronauts yet. It's already been there on a test flight. And to kind of get a hold of what SpaceX wants to do more broadly, this is just one small step in like a really big, like a super big leap that they want to take. I mean, over the years, Musk has repeatedly said that he started SpaceX primarily to actually help humanity colonize Mars. And so everything that he is doing in space and here on Earth basically is kind of leading toward that goal, trying to get us one step closer. And like, just as an example, you know, SpaceX, like one of the things they're most famous for is their like rocket reusability, where people have probably seen clips on YouTube of them, like they'll launch a satellite or like a cargo dragon, and about 10 minutes after launch, and the giant first stage of the rocket comes back to Earth for a vertical landing on like on a landing pad or on a ship at sea. Like, it's really cool, and that's also, that makes a lot of sense economically, because like you get to reuse that big piece of hardware. It's very complicated and very expensive. So what Musk wants to do is to make that the sort of norm in spaceflight, where you don't throw away parts after you use them. You know, you like you get your parts back and you refly them. And his whole goal is to slash the sort of cost of spaceflight, which has been prohibitively high for so long. And by doing that, then we'll make possible all sorts of really cool exploration things.
As NASA partners with private technology companies, is SpaceX the only game in town?
No, actually, Boeing has a similar deal to fly astronauts to the space station for NASA. They're a little bit behind, though. They still haven't done that, or they haven't aced that like uncrewed test mission to the space station that SpaceX has already done. Boeing tried to do it this past December, but they had some problems during flight, and they actually were not able to actually rendezvous with the space station as planned. So they're going to have to refly that with no astronauts on board. They're like a capsule, which is called Starliner. Like, they're going to have to refly Starliner to the space station with nobody on board, and then they'll be able to do this crewed test flight that we're seeing SpaceX try on Saturday. So they're in the works too. They're just a little behind SpaceX.
Now, for this thing that, again, was supposed to go up today, hopefully goes up this weekend if their plans come through, can you compare and contrast how this works versus the space shuttles that we might remember from 9+ years back?
Yeah, they're very different machines. You know, I mean, we're talking about how cool like the sort of space shuttle was a space plane, and it was gigantic. It had this huge cargo bay that could take up big satellites, and it was a really big thing, and it looked really cool, and it would come back down to Earth for sort of gliding runway landings. But as we saw over the years, you know, it flew 135 of these missions to space, and two of them failed with sort of catastrophic consequences. You know, 7 people on board died each time. And so while it was a really amazing feat of engineering to have this like reusable space plane, in sort of retrospect, it was extremely expensive, and it was a bit more sort of risky than we'd like to accept. And so SpaceX has gone back to the sort of tried and true capsule design, and that's the same with actually Boeing's capsule too. It's a capsule like the old Apollo capsules, this sort of gumdrop shape, which is very aerodynamically sound, and like fewer things can sort of go wrong. There are fewer weak points in that design. So both of them have kind of gone back to the standard, not trying to be super futuristic or anything. And both of the new capsules can seat 7 people, and that was the crew size for the space shuttle missions too. They all could accommodate 7 people as well. So there are some commonalities, but yeah, it's very, very different watching the sort of space shuttle on the pad, this gigantic thing with that huge external fuel tank. People remember that big orange tank. And here we just see like a little capsule on the top of a rocket. It's a very different thing to sort of behold.
We'll keep watching this weekend. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Mike Wall is a senior space writer for space.com and author of the book Out There, A Scientific Guide to Alien Life, Antimatter, and Human Space Travel for the Cosmically Curious. We talked to him about today's postponed launch of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket and Crew Dragon capsule. They're going to hope for more favorable weather for a launch over the weekend. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at yesterday's killing of a black man by a police officer in Minneapolis, the response to that, and the latest in a long conversation about race in the United States. High school and college grads are entering a tough job landscape with high unemployment during a pandemic. A new report brings us the latest, and you can share your experiences. And Let's Draw, an artist gives us drawing advice to help take up a new hobby. And if you're shy about your drawing, don't worry, you're better than I am. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7, if you're looking for some great programs to binge watch, Kate's guest has some suggestions for you. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a new project from The New York Times examines the history behind the title, Mrs., how it was used in the paper's history, and the cultural significance it held. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.